No, I won't back down. No, I won't back down. I'm Stephen Harper standing at the gates of hell, and I won't back. Whoa, what the heck? Superstar Canadian actor Mike Myers? What are you doing here?
Whoa, yourself, former Prime Minister Stephen Harper. I just finished recording an election ad for the Liberals. What are you doing here?
Well, what do you know? I also just finished shooting an ad for my good buddy Pierre. Pierre Poilievre. I just call him Pierre because, we're brothers of different mothers.
Okay, well, good luck with that. I've been in lots of television shows and movies, but this is my first time in a campaign ad. I know we're supporting different parties, but can you give me any advice on how to connect with the electorate?
Well, the one thing I can tell you is that you have to be sincere. Voters can spot insincerity a mile away. Oh, and don't let them put too much makeup on you before the cameras roll. Hey, now that I say that, you're looking pretty pasty. Did they call in a mortician to apply the pancake makeup?
Oh, slower roll there, Stevie. You are wearing so much lipstick, you look like Lady Gaga on her way out to a drag queen convention.
Oh, come on, man. That's just mean. I mean, we're both older guys, and obviously, they want us to look our best when we do campaign ads. I guess maybe they got a little carried away with the makeup on both of us. How did your shoot go anyway?
It went pretty well, I guess. Mark Carney and I were trying to be funny. I've made a living trying to be funny, so it was pretty natural for me. Carney, well, let's just say that as a comedian, he makes a great central bank governor.
My ad shoot went well too, although for some reason they wanted me to smile at the end.
Oh my God, no. Everyone knows you never smile. I've seen pictures of you at your children's birthday parties and you're not even smiling. Why would they do that?
I have no idea. I tried my best. Here, I've got a copy of the video on my phone. What do you think?
Oh, that's not good. On the other hand, your lipstick looks great.
The Winnipeg Free Press proudly presents, in partnership with CJNU 93.7 FM, Negan and the Lone Ranger. Here are your hosts, Negan Sinclair and Dan the Lone Ranger Lett.
Bonjour, Tadse. Bonjour, greetings. Welcome to this week's podcast. We're very excited to bring you this very special last week before the apocalypse. I mean, the federal election version of the
The
podcast.
apocalyptic federal election. Yeah.
Are you ready, Dan? Are you ready for what will be what everyone's calling the most important election until the next one?
Until the next one. I will say, I know that people who don't read my columns would believe this, but I think people who know me know this. I really don't care who wins. Like I, you know,
Wow.
I no no I like I don't as a journalist I don't really care who wins because for the most
Some people might
part
call that blasphemous just for saying that alone. It is the time of the resurrection right now.
no I mean I have strong opinions about the ideas that different parties have but I'm not really invested in who wins and I also don't buy into the narrative. I hate it when politicians say, "Oh, you got to vote for me because the other guy he's going to ruin the country." Dun, dun, dun. Like,
Well, I think if
I don't like that.
you've just put up the white flag for Donald Trump, apparently, in lots of people's eyes, you've just said, if you don't
Okay, yeah.
care, then.
There's a flashing sidebar light going off on my screen right now. You know what? There is one notable exception. Honestly, I thought it would be horrible what's happening in the U.S., but it's even worse than I thought. But that having been said, all I really like my best experiences covering elections have been when the outcome was in doubt. Like for a journalist, that makes great content,
It's
you
exciting
know?
right till the end. In fact, I watched a news segment last night, which I don't think I've ever seen before, but it was how BC, the 10 or 20 or so kind of seats on Vancouver Island, inside of Vancouver, things that have been traditionally totally anomalous in the country because they tend to go NDP are now all up for grabs. And
yep.
The question will be, will those 10, 20 seats or so, which typically never have any role to play in the federal election because the election is decided by that point, will they be a part of the major, you know, pushing one party over the edge or not? Here's what I care about. I do care about if there will be a solid majority, because if there is a solid majority, that says a lot about the ways in which the country can at least move faster than slower when it comes to dealing with these major aggressions from the United States.
Totally agree. I think the, I mean, I am, even though I don't really, I'm not going to lose sleep over who wins this election. I would say I'm disappointed in the tenor of some of the campaigns. I mean, you know, we, with all due respect to our friend of the podcast, Jagmeet Singh, who, you know, has been on, you know, we've interviewed him a few times, and, you know, I think he's a genuinely
committed guy.
Yeah, he's a great guy. You know, but the NDP are going to get their asses handed to them in this election. There's no doubt. Beyond that, this has become a battle between, you know, Pierre Poilievre and the Conservatives trying to conceal their true intentions once they form government and doing a horrible job at it.
Well, especially like it's almost like it just leaks out there when their platform comes out. They're like, okay, we're going to release this after 7 million people have done an advanced polling, and now we're announcing we're going to ban wokeness.
So, you know, then, you know, the other major party, the Liberals, who I'm going to refer to as, at least until they start doing something, demonstrating a little more background, as the coward Liberals. So this is a, like they found a riff, you know, I'm the guy to fight Trump. And it is so eclipsed everything else that the Liberals believe in that they won't talk about climate change. They won't talk about, you know, protecting LGBTQ or trans people. They won't talk about, you know, protecting or supporting the idea of harm reduction and supervised consumption of drugs. Now, these are all things that we think, you know, we're pretty sure the Liberals stand for, like that they support these things.
Yeah, but that's the past, not this election cycle.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it is arguably in the platform, but also in the platform are some of the most, I don't know, what you would call it? Would you call it Paul Martin-esque, kind of drag the party much more centrist than they have been for quite a long time?
I think that they've decided to fight the election on the most stable ground, and the most stable ground is fight Trump, like portray yourself as the guy who can stand up to Trump. And I would say, caretaker convention notwithstanding, he's done a pretty good job. I mean, he had the opportunity to stand up to Trump, and he's done a pretty good job with it. And then the other part of it is focus on boosting the economy and dealing with the housing shortage. And I will say as well, for those of us who really like to get deep into policy, there's quite an interesting contrast, particularly on housing, on the way the two parties would approach it. And that's good for the electorate. So well, the conservatives want to grease the wheels for the private sector, so that they will build more homes, and the supply itself will make homes, housing, either to buy or rent more affordable. And then the Liberals want to take a post-war approach where the government is directly involved in, as Mr. Carney likes to say, catalyzing the construction of more homes, but building homes specifically to be, you know, with the fall within the affordable category. So, you know what, like, depending on how you think we should address the problem, you have two distinct agendas there, and that's good.
Well, there are some other wedge issues. I mean, the CBC is the number one probably that comes to mind right away. Either look at a party that's going to defund it or double down on it. I mean, that's a pretty clear choice as well. There are some issues. Resoundingly, though, they've both doubled down on the build baby build kind of approach. And that, I think, is really indicative of what I was writing about this week, which was you've got a lot of similarities when it comes to when you drag the Liberal Party to the center, and then you've got the Conservatives who are always quite aggressive on land and resource use. You've got a recipe for a very dicey situation for Indigenous peoples, which has been what the Liberals have put a lot of chips in the middle to try to change in the past. And maybe you've seen, maybe you're seeing something that maybe harkens to the past, that when Canada has resource use, Indigenous peoples are always going to be caught in the crosshairs. There is one very interesting part amongst the Liberal platform that I pointed out, that legislating a right to water, which put Canada right in a very tough bind, because as we know, Justin Trudeau's commitment to try to fix boil water advisories, he, regardless of the amount of political capital he put in that, he just couldn't seem to get rid of that issue, or he couldn't seem to fix that issue. There's still about three dozen water advisories across the country. So certainly there's an interesting future going forward. The parties are both not different and then quite different.
Don't you get the impression, though, especially with both parties talking about expediting the approval of, pipelines and mines and other resource projects, that that there are, genuinely there are First Nations who have a compelling legal argument to control the use of a lot of land that falls within these resource areas, that they're already packing their bags and getting ready for the blockades.
Oh, I can tell you that in the circles that I travel in, there's no trusting either one of the leader parties. And there's a batten down the hatches approach. There's also a, and this is kind of, I think I plan on writing about this as soon as the election is finished. There is an undercurrent of liberal chiefs in Manitoba, across the country, but I would say headed off in Manitoba, that are very strong federal Liberal Party members. And there will be an interesting break between leadership and grassroots people around this issue of resource development, because so many First Nations chiefs, I once wrote a report or a column, sorry, that said that the three major Grand Chiefs of Manitoba were all of their campaigns were run by federal Liberals. And they were all of them, like even today, if you look at the Grand Chief of the Assembly Manitoba Chiefs, the MKO Garrison Sateen, who's probably the most distanced but has the provincial Liberals certainly in his past, and the of course Jerry Daniels with the SCO, these are all hardcore federal Liberals who have had deep ties with the party in one way or another. And then of course National Chief Cindy Woodhouse is the former chair of the Aboriginal People's Commission of the party, and so there is deep ties within the Indigenous community, and leadership is what I mean, with the federal Liberals. And that will be very interesting to see going forward, because if it's a build baby build approach, the grassroots of many communities are not on board for that.
No, and as we know, in particular in Manitoba, many of the resource projects here, everything from Bipole 3, the additional transmission line for Manitoba Hydro, to new dams, to mining pro like First Nations people will get, in some respects, will get the final say on whether we expedite or not. And I think it's pretty clear that neither of the two leaders, the ones that are competing to form government, have really taken that into account. But more importantly, do you want to know what the result is going to be next week? Would you like to know exactly
Oh,
what's going to
I've
happen?
been waited with bated breath, not for the election, but for the most brilliant prognosticator panel ever assembled on any podcast or show ever seen before, is right here hosted on this on the Negan and Lone Ranger podcast. We've got coming forward, returning in the third period to come save the day, Dan Lett, Dan the prophesizer Lett. We've got Curtis Brown, who not only has a crystal ball, but also has knowns all knows which horse will to bet upon. And then we've got Chris Adams, of course, my colleague at the University of Manitoba, who is well known for being able to throw tea leaves on the table and tell you exactly to the T how many people will vote in which direction. So we've got this amazing panel, and as we've found out, I've been eliminated. Like Survivor said, you're not welcome because I was not prepared last time.
That's okay. I think you're probably like, given the fact that the Conservatives may win the election and they're going to defund the CBC, I think you're probably just working overtime to get a couple extra CBC checks in before the deadline. Oh, was I not supposed to say that? Sorry. No. This
I
is
don't like
I
truth. Okay, I don't like
yeah
truth
yeah.
in
So truth before reconciliation, baby.
podcast.
No, I would say the panel that we first convened for the last provincial election is technically batting 1,000. The last provincial
Correctly
election,
called, with the
nailed it.
exception of only a few slivers of difference,
Yeah.
correctly called
So
that election.
we now toss to the prognosticators panel a much more complex problem. We expect nothing less than a completely definitive opinion on who's going to win.
Get your pencils out.
We're reviving a panel that appeared on one of our most popular podcast episodes ever, the Election Prognosticators panel. Not satisfied with resting on our laurels, we've added a character to the panel today to ensure that we are covering the entire province thoughtfully. So joining me is Christopher Adams, professor of political science at the University of Manitoba. Curtis Brown is a principal at Probe Research, the Free Press's pollster of choice, bracket, if you only have one poll to do, please go to Probe, close bracket. And Devon Ross, who is a political columnist for the Winnipeg Free Press and an editorial writer for the Brandon Sun, and comes to us from outside the perimeter highway to make sure that the three people who always write to me and tell me that I only cover politics inside the perimeter can stuff it. So there, we're good. Good morning, everybody.
Morning.
Morning, Dan.
Morning, Dan.
So as we're talking this morning, we are, oh my God, 5 days away from Election Day. Actually, probably 4 days from Election Day in a few hours. And we have new poll results for Manitoba and Winnipeg that Probe has provided to the Winnipeg Free Press. So just to get us going, Curtis, tell us what the new results are telling us about the race in Manitoba.
Yeah, it's interesting. We've had a little bit of a it's been a shift in the last little while. We've had things have kind of changed a bit kind of over the last couple months, obviously, and we're seeing that nationally. But in our latest poll, which we did in mid-April, very recently, we did see the it basically, if you look at the overall picture for Manitoba, the Liberals and the Conservatives are very close. The Liberals at 43, the Conservatives at 40, which is pretty similar to our last poll that we did in March. But the one trend that's really held, and I think that really makes a big difference, and that we'll be talking about, is that the Liberal lead in Winnipeg is still huge. They're at 50%. The Conservatives basically haven't changed. They're at 32. So that really bodes well for the Liberals in terms of not only keeping the seats they have, but also maybe potentially winning some more. And the other thing that's really important to note in this poll is that we've picked up the there was a collapse certainly in the NDP vote. Certainly around the time before leading up to the campaign and sort of when the campaign initially began, they were down at 9% in a poll that we did in March, and in this one they're actually up a little bit. They're back up to 15. So what that would mean for them probably is they'd be a little bit more competitive. It looked like they could have been almost wiped out in Manitoba, but this time around, yeah, it looks like they might be, in a spot to be able to, fight to keep some, one or two or even three of the seats they have.
Chris, are you do you continue to be somewhat surprised by the strength of the Liberal vote in Winnipeg? And I'm wondering if you think that like obviously the parties are doing polling as well. It's good to have the support of theoretical voters in a poll, but do you think the Liberals will be able to seize the opportunity that these numbers suggest?
But they don't have the workers that the Conservative Party has, or the NDP is, So one thing is to see these numbers. But much of this, it just brings to mind 2015, and when much of Winnipeg like just went red with a couple of exceptions. So I'm expecting 2015 will be repeated again here. As Curtis was saying, the numbers have changed so much, and this Pro poll is really timely. Just came out last night, and I'm just looking at the press release this morning, and it's really quite something that the dramatic thing in Winnipeg of 20-point increase from December to February and March, and now seeing this, it's dipped a little bit for the Liberals in Winnipeg. But I would say that I've never I worked in the industry for 20 years, and I've been involved in political science for an additional 15 years, and I've never seen numbers change like this, and it's really quite startling for Winnipeg. But I am expecting a very similar outcome to what we saw in 2015.
Devrin, in the view from Brandon, where from your perch you can see much of what's going on in Westmann, but also I think your network reaches into a lot of rural ridings. So I think I'd ask you the same question, which is, if the Liberals and Conservatives are running neck and neck province-wide, that makes them much more competitive as well outside Winnipeg. But, will they have put the candidates and resources in place to take advantage of those trends?
No, they didn't. And realistically, Chris was talking about this. The surge in Liberal support, frankly, caught Liberals by surprise as well. A lot of the candidate recruitment, the fundraising, obviously, there wasn't a lot of fundraising, but decisions were made at a time when the Liberals were trailing, the Tories by more than 20 points nationally, and that had an impact on candidate recruitment, obviously, on fundraising, on preparations. So. It's clear that the Liberals' focus has been on inside the perimeter, winning those seats in Winnipeg, and rural Manitoba's largely been left to shrivel on the vine, which is a shame because there was a scenario under which Brandon was winnable. You recall that the Liberals came within a few hundred votes of winning Brandon in a 2013 by-election, and from an organizational standpoint, there were candidates with name recognition willing to run in Brandon, and the party instead chose a person who, frankly, wasn't even known by the riding association, and who has been completely invisible during this campaign. And it wouldn't surprise me if the Liberals place a distant third here in Brandon, which is a shame, because there was a legitimate shot at winning this riding, and even with strategic voting at this point, enough votes are going to go to the Liberals to prevent the NDP, the NDP candidate, a good candidate named Quentin Robinson, from winning out here. It's unfortunate because I don't think we got the campaign that we should have received.
It's interesting. I'm wondering, does anybody think that the Liberal numbers are strong enough? Because there are examples. I mean, Chris, you recall 2015. I'll actually go back farther to 1993, to Jean Chrétien's Red Wave. It's what I mean. Devrin and I talk about this quite often, but it's what we call the Glenn MacKinnon phenomena. So, Glenn MacKinnon was a retired school principal who got his name on the ballot late, and they kind of gave him a box of handbills and some signs and whatever. And he admitted to me later that he didn't really campaign, and he won his seat. So are the numbers at a stage where we could see the Liberals succeed despite some of their organizational efforts, Chris?
Well, I think when voters go into the voting booth, they have three dimensions they usually vote on, and that's the local candidate, the party brand, and the leader. And more over the past 40, you all know this, is over the past 40 years, the leader has become more significant in that decision mix. So I would say that in Canada, there will be some, if the surge for Mark Carney is real, and I think it is, there will be some candidates, much like the orange wave in Quebec when that bartender at Carleton University was in Vegas and she found out she won her Quebec riding. And I think she's running again in this election.
She is.
Yes, yep. She is. Yep. Although this time I think she's staying in Quebec for like a radical change in strategy. So
yeah, but what I was going to ask Endeavor, and it's nice to chat with you again. Last time I saw you, you were playing bass guitar at the Central Hotel in my neighborhood, Transcona.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So, but I do want to say that outside of Winnipeg, one thing, a big question mark, I think, is Churchill Kuwait Nagaski. Is will Nikki Ashton hold on against Liberal Rebecca Chartrand? And I think that's, if there's something outside of Winnipeg that might very well go to the Liberals, that's the one that I'm watching.
I agree.
Curtis, what do you think? Is there, like, obviously, I think we're all super pumped for election night because it's going to be kind of like 2015. Like it's going to be like a real nail. Like it's going to be interesting to watch the narrative of election night. But is there a chance for the Liberals in Winnipeg to possibly capture seats that they didn't really put any effort into?
Well, I mean, I think the only one that would maybe kind of fit that bill is Kildonan and St. Paul. And I guess it's a good question of what that might look like, right? I think, Winnipeg West, you know, that's one I think now that our attention has shifted to in terms of it being close, but it's a different animal, right? Because you have the same candidates running, you know, like the two same candidates that run against each other in three elections. It's a former MP running for the Liberals. It's a different kind of a thing. Kildonan St. Paul, I don't think the Liberals have really put a significant amount of effort in. I don't think they really expected to win, you know, but it would be kind of like, that would be one that would probably be a bit more, you know, like Brandon Souris. I mean, I'm from Brandon and Westman too, and Devon and I go way back. I think it's, you know, like that is always going to be the one that is, you know, I think, you know, of all the sort of yellow dog conservative seats in Manitoba, that's the one where they would be the closest. But I think the difference, like to your point about the Glenda McKinnon effect, is like in that case, I mean, you had the conservative vote split. And in this case, I think it's more, you know, it's the other way, right? The Liberals and the NDP might split. I mean, there's a situation and a scenario where, you know, the Liberals could win and they came close in that by-election, you know, sort of when Trudeau was at the height of his popularity. But even in the 2015 election, you know, they lost by 12, 14 points. I mean, yes, with a really strong local candidate and, you know, really good numbers kind of going up, the Liberals could, I think, really come close in that seat. But yeah, they really need a pretty significant lift to be able to, you know, actually be able to take it and keep it. And then probably that would be conservative target number one in the election, in the election to come.
Devrin, you go ahead and talk about your observations about Kildonan and St. Paul.
So I've talked to a number of Liberals working in Winnipeg, and frankly, Kildonan and St. Paul was not on their radar 2 months ago, 4 months, certainly not 4 months ago. They regarded Raquel Dancho as a strong MP who was safe. They deeply regret that now because they realize, based on the numbers they're seeing now, that seat could be in play, and they are reconsidering the resources they put in there, the candidate that they have. They see that potentially as a lost opportunity. But having said that, the level of support there could create a slipstream or a vortex that elects the Liberal candidate there, and so it is the McKinnon factor potentially, but we're going to see that across the country, as Chris said, not, you know, analogous to the orange wave that we saw with Ruth Allen Brousseau and others. And to Curtis's point, Winnipeg West has been a contest from the day of the election in 2021. Doug Eielson has been committed to winning that back, and I think it was very close back in 2021. But Kildonan and St. Paul, Raquel Dancho has been, you know, basically a star in that conservative caucus. If she loses this, that's a bellwether for the nation.
So I'm not at this stage going to ask you to predict the results of Manitoba's 14 ridings, but I will ask you later on to do that. So I don't want you to think you're getting off the hook. Let's talk a little bit about the national picture, because there are other areas of the country where the Liberal support has surged to alarmingly high numbers. And I'm going to pick two of those because because I've done a lot of reading about them and I'm fluent, so it's going to make the podcast sound a lot better. But Atlantic Canada, probably not as much of a surprise how well the Liberals are doing there, because that just seems to be the region of the country. They are the last to abandon the Liberals in any meaningful way. But the GTA, the Greater Toronto Area, like the numbers that are coming back from there are really like harken back really to the Chrétien years and how the Liberals just like completely wiped out, like they just consumed all the seats in Ontario. Chris, what do you think? Like the Atlantic Canada and the GTA, anything there that you find really surprising?
Well, one thing, remember the 1993 election and throughout the 90s is the conservatives were split, right, between the Reform Party and the Progressive Conservative Party. And so Chrétien's huge successes in part was the demobilization of the conservative vote into two different parties. And we don't have that scenario this time around. Like the PPC, the People's Party of Canada, is not a player at all in this election. So I would say some of the dynamics are different. In fact, Chrétien won a couple of outside of Winnipeg seats. I'm thinking of David F. Tottie in 93, who held it until his tragic death later that decade. But that was outside of Winnipeg. But I would say, back to your question, one thing I agree with about Atlantic Canada, I would say what I'm finding really fascinating about Ontario is that the slings and arrows between the provincial Doug Ford PCs and Jenny Byrne and the federal conservatives. It's really something like Corey Tenike, who is the campaign director for Doug Ford, sort of calling the federal conservatives a campaign catastrophe. And so I don't think I've ever seen this sort of open battle between a provincial PC party and the federal conservatives. But Ontario right now, the data that we're looking at is they're running away with the show. Tonight himself put out some data from the Ontario PCs, leaked it purposely out, and it's just a fascinating thing to watch.
Well, and that leads into our colleague Bob Fyfe at the Globe and Mail, relying on that PC Party of Ontario polling and some Liberal polling, suggesting that Pierre Poilievre is in trouble in his own riding at Ottawa-Carleton. I suppose that like I never find it surprising when the leader of a party with negative momentum, finds themselves personally, under the gun. But again, like the numbers coming from the Greater Ottawa area, like the Liberals are thriving, in a significant fashion. And as for Doug Ford and Corey and the sniping and whatever, I think Doug Ford has pretty much proven that Doug Ford is in it for Doug Ford, and he's not going to do anything that might even allow people to quietly suggest that he's in league with Pierre Poilievre. Yeah, they may be the same color party, but beyond that, Curtis, what do you think?
Yeah, I would agree with a lot of that. And I think, I mean, really for me, yeah, when I kind of look at like the election overall, and it's trite to say, but yeah, it does come down to the GTA. And you do have, this massive number of people who just would have voted for the PCs and the 905 region and around Toronto, for Doug Ford, now kind of all going to Liberals. And it seems like, like that is, the group that really kind of switches back and forth and really ultimately decides things. I think the other factor to keep in mind too is, I mean, I think, we've seen a little bit of life in our, for the NDP in Manitoba in our poll. And I mean, that's not something that's necessarily going to get picked up at the national level. The NDP, the other thing here too, the Conservatives need a stronger NDP. One of the reasons Doug Ford did reasonably well and won his provincial election pretty easily is that the Liberals and the NDP are fairly split in Ontario, and it allows the Conservatives to win a lot of those suburban seats. The NDP is like a non-factor. Even with Jagmeet Singh, he's not running in the GTA, but he's from Brampton, and that was part of the reason for picking him. I think was that he'd hopefully be able to for the NDP be able to help them make inroads in the Toronto area and the GTA in particular, where all the seats are. But I mean, the NDP could be looking at like not only a lot of Liberals getting elected in suburban Ottawa, suburban Toronto, but I mean, they might be in trouble in seats like Hamilton Centre, Windsor West, some of the ones that are kind of, bedrock blue collar traditional NDP seats. And then actually the Conservatives might end up being the beneficiary of in some cases where the NDP vote is collapsed, especially in also in Northern Ontario and places like that. So, I think it's, that's to me one of kind of the, when you kind of look at the rest of the country, that's one of the most fascinating things that, that in terms of the dynamics that I see.
So when, I suppose like if you're like me, your friends and family, everybody's kind of asked you the main question, which is, for this campaign, is less a little bit about the appeal of Mark Carney, because he's a pretty classic liberal, middle of the road, guy with apparently, if again the polls think that he has much better credentials and bona fides on economic issues, which is probably true. But it's how did the Conservatives get into this place? And I think Devrin, you mentioned that. Corey Teneke actually suggested that it was malpractice. I think that was his word, malpractice.
Malpractice.
Yeah, political malpractice. Yeah, I've been thinking about this just as you guys were talking, and I think the election campaign, we haven't said it, but I think it's obvious, has become a referendum on Pierre Poilievre, and our confidence in him, his character, and his leadership abilities, and his competency to deal with Donald Trump. I think. The focus shifted at some point during the campaign, and he's come up short, and he's particularly come up short in we talk about the Liberal support in Atlantic Canada. Atlantic Canada has an aging population, one of the older populations in the country, and of course, the Liberals surprisingly are seeing a lot of support among people 55 and up, which is surprising because Tories used to own that age category. But I think there's a correlation there in Atlantic Canada, but in Ontario, and particularly in the GTA, Southern Ontario, which is ground zero for Trump's tariffs, it's not hard to understand why they would shift to the Liberals if they don't have confidence in Pierre Poilievre to protect their interests. And I think that it may be becoming that referendum on the Tory leader as to whether they believe he's the guy for the times.
If I could add to that, the polling last year, correct me, Curtis, if I'm wrong, but the polling nationally, Pierre was not a very popular guy when people are asked about their view of Pierre. So the Justin Trudeau was so unpopular that people were forgetting, weren't noticing that people didn't really like Poilievre, but people are thinking it's time for a change. So when Justin Trudeau disappears, and we get the shiny new penny of Mark Carney, who typically after leadership conventions, there usually is some sort of a bump for a well-known party. So we've got suddenly the view, and I agree with Devrin completely, this has turned into a referendum about Poilievre. And I think because Trudeau's gone, and now we look at this guy, and people aren't happy with what they see. I know... the data now are showing like who showed up at the advanced polls. A lot of them are Liberal supporters who are just voting to get Poilievre out of the picture.
Curtis, I was just going to say, if you noticed the shift in Conservative campaign ads in the last week, first notable thing is that Poilievre is gone. Like they are no longer running any ads with his image or name. The second thing, though, and I thought at first it was a sort of a, I was going to be guilty of a nuanced observation, but I actually think it's way more obvious. The ad of the two older guys, they're on the practice range at a golf course, and they're talking about, you're not really going to give those jokers another term, blah, blah, blah.
Clowns.
And I thought. I have never seen a conservative party or a progressive conservative party trying to shore up voters who are supposed to be their core of support. they're running an ad to remind their core voters, hey, you guys vote conservative, right? Like, don't get swayed by the former Bank of Canada. Like, am I overstating like this is astounding to me.
No, you're absolutely right. It is astounding. That is a really interesting and I think actually very good ad. Because it is because I think yeah, older men are kind of the wobbly leg right now in the suddenly grown liberal stool here. It is interesting. Like to Chris's point, I think it's true that yeah, people weren't necessarily in love with Poilievre, and it was more a lot of Trudeau fatigue. But Poilievre is actually, and we've seen this in our polling, actually quite popular, relatively popular among younger men or, men under the age of, 45, which I guess, we'll say that's younger, sort of creeping into middle age a little bit.
It is on this panel, I'll tell
Well,
you.
yeah. But it's been, but the liberal shift or the liberal surge has been kind of driven by seniors. And yeah, I mean, we know that men tend to be more likely to support conservative parties than women sort of, and that's been the case for many, many, many years. But yeah, with everything kind of happening with Trump and whatnot, that they started, older men started to drift over into the liberal camp and prefer Mark Carney and all that. And so yeah, this is the, I think it's yeah, very blatant. The conservatives are trying to win that demographic back, and that also is a demographic that's also I think compared certainly to younger people are more likely to be tuned in and more likely to vote and that sort of thing as well. So that also makes a difference.
While they have abandoned Poilievre and they are expressing some concern about lost votes in that older male demographic, the one thing that they haven't done is the conservatives have not completely abandoned that Trump light kind of policy basis. So in today's newspapers online, there's a story about how in Atlantic Canada, Poilievre promised that if his party's elected, he's going to get rid of all government, incentives to buy electric vehicles. Now, this is like 100% out of the Trump playbook, and he portrayed the government incentives as an assault on the liberty and freedom of Canadians to buy whatever kind of car that they want. Well, the fact is the only restriction on freedom in this equation is that most of us who want to buy electric vehicles can't get one. Because and all the car makers want to go to electric. They want to shift to electric. They see that as the future. Is anybody surprised that they're still trying to roll, and who are they speaking to when they roll this out? Because I don't know who is going to think that's a really good idea.
Well, I would say that, I mean, Doug Ford did the same thing in the 2018 Ontario election. The liberal government in Ontario had a lot of incentives for people to buy electric vehicles, and he said, this is elitist, and we're subsidizing people to buy these expensive cars, and so we're going to get rid of it. So I think it does kind of tie into kind of that populist approach, and especially also, sort of ties into also the, I think the other kind of core of the conservative message in some ways, which is about, supporting, the Canadian oil and gas and energy industry, as opposed to, we're not going to give people a bunch of money to buy these expensive cars. And, I think for a lot of people may also perceive that to be kind of out of their range anyway. So I'm not sure that is totally the Trumpy piece, but I think also, the other thing is, yeah, like the conservative coalition also includes a lot of people who, despite all this, actually don't think Trump, what Trump is doing actually isn't all bad. So they can't really attack in the same way, right?
Devrin?
I look at it from a different perspective. I think what they're doing with micro announcements like that is they're trying to shore up again another section of their support to ensure that they show up and vote. In this case, it's the more People's Party constituency within there that resents these types of incentives, resents electric cars, and who feel are concerned that the party in its desperation to pull this one out of the fire may abandon them and may abandon the policies that are important to them. So, I've been hearing this over the last few days that you dance with the one that brung you, and this is an important part of their base. They're locked in somewhere around 38, 39%, and they want to make sure that all of that decides to get out and vote and not just stay home.
it does bring forward sort of something that we've seen play out in Manitoba, but which is kind of a like it certainly seemed to be part of the conservative playbook before Justin Trudeau left the scene, which is they were trying to curry favor with voters who were farther out on the right wing of the political spectrum. So all of Poilievre's talk about anti-woke this and anti-woke that, and threatening to call wokeness from the civil service, his interview with the Jewish News in Winnipeg, where he suggested shutting down museum exhibits that weren't in keeping with the government's anti-woke ideology, and even things like the only long form interview I can remember him doing is was with Jordan Peterson when he did Jordan Peterson's podcast. So like that seems to speak to this theory, and we saw it play out in Manitoba, that there's this great white whale out there. There are all these non-traditional voters, a farther right ideology that can be mobilized to, to at the last moment. Chris, do you think these people exist, and could they be mobilized?
Well, we had Curtis's colleague, Mary Agnes Welch, on a panel we ran at St. Paul's College just down the hall here the other day. And we asked the question, is the Conservative Party support underrepresented in the polling numbers, just like Trump's numbers were underrepresented? I'm not talking about projections. I'm just talking about the polling numbers. And it's not because of shy Trump voters. That's kind of a myth. It's more like the sampling. The sampling in some polling, I think, is missing the lower educated voters or people, non-voters, who might show up to vote. And Saskatchewan election, the poll, most elections are called very well, but Saskatchewan election was a miss for the pollsters. And because I think their sampling was underrepresenting a certain part of the population that would have supported the Conservatives, but was missed by some of the surveys. We had the NDP surging in Saskatchewan according to the final polls, but that was wrong. What I'm wondering about is, are there, back to your question, Dan, are there supporters for Poilievre that aren't getting picked up in the sampling? I think there are. I don't know if it's magnificently large, but I do think that there is. We might be surprised by some of the numbers that might we might see a little bit higher support for Poilievre than what we're getting in the polls.
The NDP is showing a little bit better in BC. I think that's a trend. The Bloc is seeing a bit of a bounce from the televised debates. But the conventional wisdom, Curtis, has always been that if that strategy works to draw in voters who aren't being captured by the polls, they're going to draw them in Alberta or Saskatchewan. That's where they're going to show up to vote. They're not necessarily going to show up to vote in Rexdale or Brampton or, places where the Tories need to be more competitive.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, but I do think it, those people are there. There may not be that many of them. It may not have that significant of a result. You're absolutely right, Dan. Yeah, more of those people are probably likely to be found in Alberta and Saskatchewan and rural Manitoba, but they are everywhere. And Chris, Chris raises a good point. I mean, that's something that we try really hard to do in our polling. But it's a big issue, is that, yeah, it's like, younger people with lower levels of education are the hardest people to get to take a survey. And we weight by education. That's something that we didn't do in the past, but we're doing it now because we're trying to make sure that we're, having a representative sample. And it is something that, yeah, that, lots of studies, and there's lots of, issues that, show that, yeah, that sometimes they tend to be underrepresented. And especially, if they're all gravitating a certain way, it could have an effect. So yeah, it's something we think about and consider for sure.
Okay, so with all of the potential variables in place and the fact that there could be some hidden votes yet to be uncovered for Pierre Poilievre and the Conservatives, the strength that the Liberals, the resilience that their numbers have shown through the campaign. So let's start nationally, and I'm not going to ask you to go through seat by seat. Like we don't have enough time to do seat by seat. Although that would be, I'm sure that would be fun. But let's just sort of talk about the end result. Who's going to win the election, and what kind of a mandate are they going to have? So, Chris, I'm going to make you go first.
Well, thanks, Dan. I wanted to hear what others to do before I put my toe in the water. But I kind of like the numbers I'm seeing from Philippe Fournier with 338 Canada. And, you know, he, as well as Eric Grenier for CBC Poll Tracker, both of them have the Liberal majority with a very high probability rating. Now, probability ratings, we know in Hillary Clinton, you know, 90% or 80% chance of winning the election, and it wasn't the case. So projections can be deceiving. But I do think that the projections we're seeing of a Liberal majority, especially when we see the Bloc Québécois has ticked up, but I don't think it's risen enough to damage the Liberals too much. And in Ontario, I think the Liberals are doing far too well. So I see a Liberal majority. And keeping in mind that Election Day is coming Monday, but, you know, we've had a 25% increase of advanced voting. And so that vote, which I think is tending towards the Liberal, that vote's been locked in last weekend. So I think that I would go with a Liberal majority. I think the NDP will lose their party status, which is 12 seats in the House of Commons. I think they will go below 12. So a Liberal majority is my prediction.
Devrin, it's time for you to earn this huge paycheck we're providing to you for doing the pod.
Well, I agree with Chris on a Liberal majority, but I'm not sure that it's going to be as big as the Poll Tracker and Fournier are suggesting. I'm thinking somewhere around the 180, the type of majority that could become a problem 2 or 3 years into the mandate when people get sick or retire. I think if the bounce back is genuine for both the Bloc and the NDP, it's going to cost the Liberals seats and potentially shift seats to the Tories in different ridings. But this doesn't feel like the 200, the 210 that I'm seeing from some pollsters in terms of predictions. We'll see. I mean, we need to factor in Trump's comments from yesterday and how that brings it back to the ballot box question that the Liberals want voters to be thinking about. I think it's a majority, but I don't think it's a massive majority.
So if I could just add, Devrin, this morning, Philippe Fournier had 186 seats in his projection.
Yeah. I'm thinking that may, depending on what happens, the difficulty here is when you start using huge numbers for projections, a lot of voters think, well, the Liberals don't need my vote. I don't need to vote, or I've always voted NDP before I can go back because we've defeated Pierre Poilievre, and it's important to have NDP MPs. They start thinking like that, and then that whittles down the Liberal majority. My bones are telling me somewhere between like 177 and 180.
Curtis?
First of all, Dan, I just say I hate when you make us do this, and I feel like I'm doing this slightly under duress.
Yeah, which is, and every time you say that, it makes me want to do it all the more. So
I know. That's fair. Yeah, I'm like, come on. Yeah. But yeah, no, I'll stick my. I would say I'm more leaning towards where Devrin is. I would say, yeah, kind of between 177 to 180. So like, that's a slight Liberal majority. I think the Conservatives will do a little bit better than maybe some of those Poll Tracker projections suggest. I think the NDP will also do a little bit better. I think they might, I don't think they will quite get to party status, but I mean, maybe 9 or 10 seats somewhere in that neighborhood. And I think that's kind of how it'll kind of shake out. But yeah, I wouldn't go so far as to predict that, yeah, the Liberals are going to end up in minority territory because of this. I mean, I guess what the closer you get to like 170, 172, that's possible. But yeah, I think kind of the way it all shakes out. And I mean, by the time the GTA votes, that's going to be what ultimately decides it, I think.
So it would be remiss of me not to engage, like to put myself through the same miserable, process that I put all of you through. The thing that I think is the wild card for me is the how thin Liberal resources on the ground may be in some winnable ridings. So I'm actually going to say Liberal minority.
Oh, look at you.
But largely based on the fact that I don't think this is a Hillary Clinton situation. There, she was betrayed. She was not a popular leader within her own party. She was still being attacked by other Democrats right up to Election Day. And that just made some, classic Democratic voters despondent. I don't like Mark Carney's lack of time in the job has taken that issue off the table. I do think there is a chance that they could become overconfident if the headlines all week long are about massive majority. You'll remember the infamous 2003 Free Press headline, "No landslide." Not one of the greatest moments of the in Free Press history, but if you spend a lot of time talking about how it's going to be a majority, people do leave it to others to bring it home. But no, I think the issue is going to be get out the vote. It's so important right now. And maybe the if the advanced polls are leaning liberal, maybe that's an indication that they have done a good enough job at getting out the votes, providing people with rides to advanced polls and calling people. And the other thing is too that although canvassing is super important, voter ID, phone banks, all parties probably rely more on that to identify voters than they do on canvassing. So maybe, but I think I'm going to hedge my bet because you guys are so like absolutely convinced it's a majority. Somebody has to say something different. So
Absolutely.
that probably explains a little bit about what we're going to predict for Manitoba. But just to bring a little light to that on the end, I'm going to go in sort of reverse order. So, Curtis, if the Liberals are going to win a majority, how many seats are they going to win in Manitoba?
Let's see.
Counting his fingers now for those of you who can't see.
Yeah, I'm just running through them in my mind. I think they will win six. So that would be South Centre, St. Boniface, St. Vital, Winnipeg North, Winnipeg West, narrowly. And I'm going to go out on a limb, Churchill, Kowatnik.
Cool. Chris?
I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 Conservative Party elected, and Winnipeg West to be Conservative. I've got well, rural outside of Winnipeg, as well as Kildonan, St. Paul. Conservatives. So I've got seven Conservatives. The Liberals I see as holding St. Boniface, St. Vital, which doesn't have an incumbent, but I think they'll win it. Winnipeg North with Kevin Lamoureux, who always bucks trends regardless of what's going on nationally. Winnipeg's South Centre, I see Ben Carr holding that, but also Winnipeg South. As we know, as Winnipeg South goes, so goes the nation. And that's been the case for the past number of years. But the NDP, I see holding on to Churchill, Kowatnik, Askey, just because of the Ashton factor. They have boots on the ground and all that. I think Rebecca Chartrand's a strong challenger, but I think NDP will hold that, as well as my neighborhood of Elmwood Transcona, where Devon Ross is always invited to come back to the Central Hotel and play his bass guitar. And the NDP, I think Leah Guzan will hold that.
Dev.
Yeah, I'm very close to both Chris and Curtis. I've got six liberals. I think they're going to take Churchill because it's traditionally such a low turnout riding, and all it takes is solid support in one large First Nation such as Norway House, and you can win that. And I think the liberals have generated enough goodwill to be in the running for that. And there may be an Ashton fatigue factor at this point in time. She doesn't spend a ton of time in the riding.
Well, she has had small but very, very entertaining problems with her expenses. I don't know how big an issue that is, but her explanation for charging family holiday expenses through the House of Commons was one of my favorite stories of 2024. Fantastic stuff.
Yeah, but if you want to win, you got to be seen, and she's not seen that enough in that riding. So I've got six liberals: St. Boniface, Winnipeg South, South Centre, West, North, and Churchill. So that's six. The two new Democrats, I agree with Chris, Elmwood Transcona and Winnipeg Centre, and the rest go to the Tories.
So me, okay. I think the Liberals are going to be plus one in the city. They're going to hold their four seats, and they're going to take Winnipeg West. And I actually kind of believe that it's. I don't think it is going to be that close. I mean, it's a riding. The Liberals have won. Doug Ellison is a strong candidate who, thanks to his role in the healthcare system, maintained a profile. In between elections. So I think they're gonna, I don't think it's gonna be a landslide, but I think it's gonna be outside that nail biter territory. Kildonan St. Paul, like, to tell you the truth, I'm not really 100% sure what's gonna happen there because of the aforementioned. I'm not sure that the Liberals have the infrastructure in place to win it. The NDP hold on to their seats. Churchill Kiwantinuk Askey, I think, is going to be held by Nikki Ashton. Nikki Ashton, who I've seen twice in Winnipeg during the campaign. So, and it would be unfair for me to say that she is not spending time in her riding. But honestly, during a campaign, I would find it hard to figure out why she would be spending any time in Winnipeg. But, then again, you never know. So I'm going to say Liberals plus one, everything else is pretty much stays the course. So there you have it. You will forever be stained by the predictions that you have made in today's podcast. Any last observations, Chris?
So in 1957, Maclean's magazine, the editorial came out a few days after the Diefenbaker victory, and the Maclean's magazine said, once again, the Canadians have chosen a liberal government, and when in fact they didn't. They defeated Louis Saint-Laurent. Diefenbaker got his minority. So people are very self-satisfied often in their predictions, and then they're showing up for what they are. So I'd be happy if I were wrong. I've only been right once, and that was Obama 2008 when I won the pool. But I've lost the pool every time since then for American politics, and so take my predictions with a grain of salt. But I'll blame Philippe Fournier if my predictions are wrong.
Fournier is a friend of the podcast, and we hate to blame him for anything, but I've taken a lot of comfort from his numbers, so I'm hoping he's going to come through for me. Devrin.
My concern is that, despite the fact that the national polls have been really stable for the past 3 weeks, basically a plus four lead for the Liberals, it doesn't feel settled. It feels volatile going into this weekend. And the countervailing factor, of course, is the reality that millions of Canadians have already voted, but it seems that there's still a lot up in the air, and that something could happen. Well, the Liberal support isn't so solid that it couldn't go somewhere else. And so I'm not sure how locked in this is. We've got the factor of the much stronger Tory ground game in terms of getting out the vote. This doesn't feel like a sure thing to me in any particular direction. I'm going to be, as I do every election night, sitting in front of my television, eating my pizza alone and yelling at the screen.
Wow. You have perfectly described the life of a working journalist. Way to go. Curtis, any last thoughts?
Yeah, I would say also the working life of a working pollster too, kind of also looking at that and nervously looking at the numbers and being, oh, okay, good. It's close. It's close to what we suggested. Yeah. I would echo what Devrin and Chris and you have said. I don't put a great deal of stock into, my predictions. I think 10 years ago I said Steve Ashton was going to be premier. So
Oh
take that for what
man,
it's worth. That's a deep bet.
you are courageous though to even acknowledge that yourself, so not leave it to someone else. So
That's why I don't like doing this, Dan. So it's because I, ten a younger, stupider version of me used to, say things like that. But yeah, I will. Yeah, we'll be watching. I would definitely agree though with what Devrin's saying. I think this does feel unsettled, especially kind of in the era and the world we live in. I mean, who knows what's going to happen on Pennsylvania Avenue in the next 72 hours or anywhere else? And so yeah, you just don't know.
I want to put a plug in for Probe Research. The polling has just been invaluable for those watching, and I used to work with you guys, but I really, really appreciate the work Probe Research and the Winnipeg Free Press as well. The journalists at the Free Press have been doing a wonderful job, not just covering the polling, but also the riding by riding work has been very detailed and very much appreciated.
If you only do one poll in your life, you should do it with Probe Research. So
It's better. It's better than our old one. On an old official, and your guess is as good as ours. So,
Yeah,
yeah. So no, that's very kind of you, Chris,
no,
and yeah, I appreciate that.
that's only slightly better than the slogan we use for this podcast, which is no comma, it's not racist. So listen, thanks very much, guys. Much appreciated. And don't be surprised if you are called to account in a future podcast to explain why your predictions were either incredibly, incredibly accurate or not so accurate. I think the overall, what's good for the country is that it's a competitive race. It's, it is, I don't know if it's a toss-up, but it's going to be very competitive, and it's going to be fun to watch the election results on Monday night, as long as you're not invested in one party or the other. Thanks very much for your time, and we will check in with you post-election. Good luck, everybody, and don't forget to vote. Well, we had hoped for a definitive opinion about what was going to happen, and I'll leave it up to listeners to decide whether or not how definitive we were.
Go out and bet. I'm sure there's some kind of place you can gamble. This is like when you open that fortune cookie and you get those numbers on that on the back. Go right away to your closest convenience store.
I think the Free Press is going to be organizing a bus trip to Kenora where sports betting is legal. I'm sure someone is offering odds on the federal election. More importantly, you were part of the panel. Do you have any predictions you want to make?
Well, the one prediction I would say I wrote about this week to say that there's a very interesting little trend. There's two seats. One is in northern Saskatchewan, the other one's in northern Manitoba. If you want to see where Indigenous peoples are going to go, the question is not whether they're conservative, liberal. The question is, will they stick with the NDP, which is a big trend. If you see those two seats go liberal, that's a Churchill, Askey, Kiewaikniuk in northern Manitoba, or it still has a long name, Destiny, Mistinippi in northern Saskatchewan. Those two seats, if they go liberal, both of them have not gone liberal in the past. They've gone NDP or conservative. If they go liberal, then I think you're going to see a wide mass movement of Indigenous peoples towards the Liberal Party. And that will be, as we've seen before, I think that will push them over the edge. That will push them to the 190 range, which will be a solid majority. And that's the two seats that I'm going to be watching on my coverage, not for just us, the Free Press, but I'm also going to be on the APTN election team.
I'm super happy that you've got a fallback plan in case the CBC is annihilated by a conservative
I'm
government.
doing a call-in show for the CBC that night, so don't think I'm just abandoning my
No,
friends over there, but.
I just worry that, I don't want you to not be able to earn a living, because I know what the Free Press pays you, and nobody can live on that,
Okay.
so.
Oh, on that note, we sometimes make jokes, or sometimes we point out that, we make our various religious references on the show. But we do have profound. Both of us have profound respect for those of us, in the Islamic communities and the Christian communities, and all the different communities that we interact with throughout our everyday work. But we want to send our love to all of our Catholic relatives, for the passing of Pope Francis. I wrote this week just how much I respected Pope Francis and how much. I know for many Catholics, this is a very painful time, and so I send my love to everybody out there.
Absolutely. It was a decade of history making by a pope. Maybe didn't live up to all the expectations that Catholics and interested non-Catholics had, but it was a historic term. We hope they find a new leader who can espouse the same grasp of humanity that Pope Francis had.
Yeah. A remarkable human. That's all that you can really strive for is just to be a good human, just to be a good person that in a community and be responsible and ethical. And speaking of responsible and ethical people, thanks to everybody yet again at the Free Press for staging our podcast. Everybody, we encourage as always, just check out our newsletters with the Free Press. Come support, keep supporting independent journalism in the country. Thanks to Paul Simon and to Wendy Cebulski.
Oh, hey, and thanks as well to Mike Myers and Stephen Harper for doing the opening.
I felt like he was in the room.
It was so realistic.
Actually, I'll say it on the record. Your Stephen Harper was pretty darn good.
Nailed it.
I think we have a role to play in future. Like, look out, Rich Little. There's a good reference for you.
No, that's not a good reference. We're moving along. Thanks, everybody, and we'll touch base with you again after the rubble and the smoke clears from next week's federal election. Good luck, and please vote, everyone.